Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I am your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Harrison Perkins. Harrison is a pastor in London City Presbyterian Church and teaches systematic theology at Edinburgh Theological Seminary. We're talking to Harrison today about his new book, Catholicity and the Covenant of Works, James Usher and the Reformed Tradition, just published by Oxford University Press. Harrison, congratulations on the book and welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a real privilege to get to be with you. I'm glad to do it.
It's great to have you here. Before we talk about the book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'd be glad to. Yeah, so like you said, I am a pastor at London City Presbyterian Church. So that is my first calling, I suppose, where I get to preach and help shepherd God's people there. And then I also do some lecturing occasionally on the side as a visiting lecturer at Edinburgh Seminary. So those are the things that I do. I'm married to Sarah. We live here in London. I'm American by birth, so I love Southern barbecue. Yeah, and those are some of the not very interesting, but most interesting things about me.
That's great. Well, tell us a little bit more about the background to this book and how you came to be interested in James Usher.
Yeah, so the book has an interesting story in some ways. So for my birthday one year, I got a copy of James Usher's Body of Divinity. And I was in seminary. I was studying at Westminster, California. And so I decided for one of my classes on the history of covenant theology that R. Scott Clark was teaching that I would make myself read this book by writing a paper on it. And so I started exploring some of Usher's covenant theology for a short paper for this course. And then it just kind of kept developing. I sort of kept expanding on it past the word limits of what I was supposed to do in that paper. I was hearing from an advisor for looking for PhD students and was asked if I'd be interested in turning this into a paper. I'd been discussing Usher things with him and it seemed like a good idea and exciting opportunity. So that's what we did. And yeah, my original plan, I suppose, was talk about Usher's covenant theology, just the broad scope of his view of how the Christian life relates to covenants. How God had made this covenant with Adam, which is what the book ended up focusing on, but then also the covenant of grace, God's one plan of salvation for all people after the fall. So that was the original plan. And as I got into it, I kept writing about the covenant of works. Not because I sort of liked it more, but because that was what Usher was talking about the most, which is interesting because, so to back up slightly, I guess the reason that I got into Usher more specifically was I kept reading about the covenant theology of the Westminster Assembly. And Usher's name kept coming up. And so I kept, you know, seeing him mentioned as this really important figure for the history of covenant theology and its development in the Reformed tradition and kept trying to find an extended explanation of his covenant theology, especially in terms of the Westminster Assembly and how those two things related. Well, that article, that book, turns out it didn't exist. And so I guess I decided, well, I'll write it. And so as I was looking at Usher's covenant theology, specifically with thinking about how people had argued already that it has relevance for the Westminster Assembly, he kept talking most about the covenant of works. And so that's what I kind of kept writing on. And eventually, you know, it's like, well, okay, this has turned into more than just one chapter, which was the original idea. This is turned into at least two chapters. Okay, now that this has spilled into three chapters worth, you know, by word count, you know, you still have to figure out how to divide it up into, to, you know, coherent sections for chapters. But this is a thesis, a book in itself. And so that's the kind of change in direction I ended up taking, was just looking at how Usher used the covenant of works and why it was of such extensive importance for him. And in that way, I would at least like to imagine that I haven't read my own position, you know, my hypothesis into the sources, because it wasn't my original hypothesis. It was one that grew out of reading Usher over and over and reading more and more across his various written and manuscript, published and manuscript sources. So that's kind of the background and even how the original idea shaped into what it is now. The book itself is actually, I think, 50. So I did start this as a PhD thesis, but this book is actually, I think, 50% longer than the thesis. Certainly went through several revisions, incorporated a lot more sources from other things, and has extensive interaction outside of what the original project was. And thankfully, Oxford was gracious and ready to publish it. And now it's out.
That's great. And we can buy it for Christmas. So, Harrison, tell us a little bit more. Who is Usher? And what did covenant theology do for him? So, tell us who Usher is. Tell us what covenant theology is. And tell us why it matters to Usher.
So, broadly speaking, James Usher, I think it's not so controversial to say, is one of the most important theologians in the history of the Church of Ireland. And still to this day. So he was a 17th century archbishop for the Church of Ireland. He was born in 1581, went to Trinity College, Dublin, did his studies there, also became professor there in the early 1600s. Did kind of a skyrocketing story to success in some ways, intellectually and ecclesiastically too. In the early 1620s, he was moved to become Bishop of Meath by James I. And then in 1625, one of the last things that James I did before he died, actually, was make Usher the Archbishop of Armagh, which is the highest position in the Church of Ireland. So he's the primate over the entire established church in Ireland. So that was kind of a very brief sketch of his life or his career up until he became archbishop. And things kept getting more interesting for him even after that, though. So shortly after he became archbishop, Charles I became the king of England and Scotland. And of course, that has relevance for Ireland as well, especially. And Charles was a guy who wanted to promote the monarchy and sort of a totalitarian view of authority in some ways. And he also appointed a guy named William Laud as the Archbishop of Canterbury, the highest position in the Church of England. And there's a back and forth, of course, between the two archbishops and what that authority relationship is like. But one of the things was the more reformed people in the established churches did not appreciate the policies that were coming out under Charles and William Laud, because they thought they were at least too ceremonialist, if not fully Roman Catholic, in some, at least in their flair. So this grew some tensions among the Reformed and people in the established church, and Usher was right in the thick of this. Usher had very strong sympathies for real, thorough Reformed theology, and so Laud's policies and doctrine, if certainly that the doctrine underlined his policies, that didn't mesh well with Usher's views. And so Usher spent a lot of time trying to keep the Church of Ireland independent with a small I, lowercase I, not in polity, but separate from the Church of England and under its own confessional heading. So they had the Irish Articles that were set in place in 1615, and Usher wanted to keep these as the confession of the Church of Ireland. In 1633-34, the 39 Articles of the Church of England were sort of imposed on the Church of Ireland. So in some ways, the Irish Articles were never rescinded, but in some ways Usher lost that battle to some degree. So that's kind of the first half, really, of Usher's career, was trying to work for a reformed and distinct Church of Ireland. The second half of his career, it may not half chronologically, but in terms of major parts, in 1640, Usher went to England for normal church business in some ways. He made these trips fairly regularly and frequently. But this time, while he was in England, the Irish Rebellion broke out, and that prevented him from coming back to Ireland. And so by the time things had settled down and he could have returned, politically, he was basically too unwell to be able to come back. And so he lived the rest of his life and carried out the rest of his career in England. Now, in the early 1640s was when the Civil War was breaking out. And so Usher got tangled up in this as well. So he started preaching. He was doing various research projects, going back and forth between Oxford, Cambridge, London. But he started preaching in London at a little place called Covent Garden. And there's records of his basically weekly sermons there for a while in early 1642. When the Civil War broke out and Charles I, Usher, despite his doctrinal differences with Charles and Laud, did think that God appointed the monarch, and so no one has right to oppose that. And so Usher relocated to Oxford, where the royalist camp was doing some research there. It appears that he was giving some theological lectures, which maybe we can come back to later in terms of their significance, but he was doing that for the 2 years roughly that he was there. Ended up back in London and preaching again. For until 1653, he died in 1656, so preached until the last 3 years of his life, died in Reigate at a big home that's still there, was buried, in some ways ironically, within Westminster Abbey. And given the sort of ongoing discussion of his connection to the Westminster Assembly, I find that really fascinating. Because Oliver Cromwell, the Lord Protector, was in charge at this point, and Usher was a royalist archbishop, and Oliver Cromwell demanded that he be buried in Westminster Abbey, and he suspended the ban on the Book of Common Prayer so that Usher's funeral could use its liturgy for that funeral service. And the Westminster Assembly had started its meetings in the Henry VII Chapel, which is up at the east end of Westminster Abbey. And Usher didn't attend the assembly because he was a royalist and had gone to Oxford. And yet he's buried in one of the little chapel areas right at the foot of the stairs that go into Henry VII Chapel. And, you know, we can make too much of these things, but it's hard to resist, you know, that just like in life, Usher was just outside the room of the Westminster Assembly, so in death, he was just outside where they met too. And I find that at least interesting and fascinating that that's how the story comes to an end. People have debated his legacy essentially since he died. There were competing stories about which party really owned Usher, the Puritans, the Anglicans, Since then, you know, the evangelicals of sorts, the Reformed evangelicals or the high churchmen, and in really still to this day, there's dispute over to whom Usher truly belongs. So that's kind of a story of who he is. I think there, covenant theology, how was covenant theology important to Usher was the other part of your question. So Usher essentially made extensive use of this doctrine, and there's a reason for it, because covenants are essentially about how God relates to his people, and they are the formal relationships in which he binds himself to his people. So one, we can think about how this was important to Usher, because Usher was a historian in some ways. He was a theologian, but he also loved history. And covenants are historical things. They are things that happened. They are things that God revealed. To think about God's covenants aren't to speculate about his decrees. They are to reflect upon what he actually did and said to his people in history. They're also about that relationship. And so the structure of these covenants, as God describes them, truly does tell us about how we're meant to relate to God. And so that's why Usher made such extensive use of this. The Irish Articles, which I've argued in a forthcoming publication, he is at least the primary author, and I think there's real evidence of that. And there's some of that in this book too, but more evidence forthcoming. Is the first Reformed confession to make use of the doctrine of the covenant of works, and then that is increased and made a bit more rounded in the Westminster Confession of Faith. And so Usher does really play a part in bringing covenant theology into the confessional tradition to some degree. So that's a sketch, I think, of his life, his work, and how he relates broadly, at least, to covenant theology.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, Harrison, much of the work you're doing for this project is quite new. It's groundbreaking, isn't it? And you explain in the book that you're interested in using manuscript sources alongside the print sources that might be a little bit better known. Tell us a little bit about how you went about using manuscript sources and some of the things you discovered.
Yeah. So one of the things about one of the rich blessings that we have doing history of the early modern period now is the easy availability of so many sources on the post-Reformation digital library, early English books online, Google Books. We can get access to most of the published works from that time. That also means that they certainly become less scarce in terms of using them. And so we need to be cutting edge. I think we need to push at least somewhat past that and certainly do more than just summarize published works. That used to be very useful. Now, because so many people can get them so easily, we need to at least to do more than summarize them, analyze them, give context, think about them more and more. Think about these, and also think about them physically. Books, we can download these digitally. That wasn't the case in the 1600s. These books had to travel from where they were published. People had to read them. And that, I mean, especially thinking about Usher in Ireland, which if you think about books published in Europe on the continent, well, they got to travel to Ireland for Usher to use them. So I can't, in working on Usher, I can't just claim, well, you know, this European book was important, so it must have been important to Usher. I need to demonstrate that he had access to this book. And that sort of thinking about the physicality of books and information distribution in the early modern period really got me thinking hard about method in general and connections and how really every connection that we try to make in historiography needs to be demonstrable. Now, that's difficult because footnotes were essentially non-existent to some degree or other in the early modern period. Sometimes marginal notes record sources, but sometimes they don't. And plagiarism was a far different kind of category back then than it is now by a long shot. But we can still think beyond just, well, did they say it? Now, certainly, if they say, I used this book, I leaned on this person's work, that's very helpful. But we can push past that. We can look at personal papers and see, did they leave records, you know, in other ways of books they were reading and thinking about? Did they take notes from other books? Did they have letters to and from other theologians and thinkers and writers that can tell us, well, they were interacting with them to some degree or other. We can also just check library records. And that can be very tedious and very difficult depending on the person and the library and when and where this was. But was the book available to a person who was studying in this library at that time? So Usher is a good person to use in that regard because there are good records of the books he owned. Of the books that he annotated. He also made a lot of notes in his personal papers about the books he read and that kind of thing. And there's a brand new, beautiful edition of his letters that tell us not only books that he was reading as he interacts with others about them, but also the theologians that he interacted with them as people. And so we have these demonstrable connections. But then when we think past even some of those things, we think, well, ideas were being disseminated in other ways. There is such thing as word of mouth, but we can't guess at that. So it may be lost to us, and that's a shame. But sometimes people write things down. So in the Usher manuscript collection, there's a good, sizable body of auditor's notes that record things that Usher said. And so other people writing down his lectures. So, for example, in 1643 to 44, when he was in Oxford, Thomas Barlow, Bishop Thomas Barlow, or the later Bishop of Thomas, Bishop Thomas Barlow, seems to write down some divinity lectures that Usher gave. Not formal lectures, I think. You know, it was more invite, would you do this for us on the side? But still, we have record of this really exciting set of lectures that would have been lost had it not been for these. The same with his sermons. Lots of people were writing down Usher's sermons and taking extensive notes on what he said and leaving them for us. So this makes, you know, Usher an exciting field of study if we want to do this demonstrable link kind of thing and not guess about who was interacting with what book and that kind of thing, and even how ideas were spread outside of the authorized eye, so to speak, of being censored or not, you know, formally recognized by the publishers and that kind of thing. So that's kind of some of the method going into this and why I've prioritized some manuscript sources. I think two of the most exciting ones, so you asked what were some things that I found. Two of the most exciting ones, there are lots of exciting ones, the sermon manuscripts and that kind of thing, but two that have been rarely used, and one of them has never been used. The 1643 and 44 lectures have been cited once, but the lectures themselves, so other bits of this manuscript have been cited, but the lectures were given in Latin, and they've never been translated, never been published, and that section has never been cited. So I do a lot with that, seeing what is he teaching divinity students. And this, so both of these documents, actually, I've worked on a translation, done a critical transcription, but also done an annotated translation. And these should be coming out in an edition with one other manuscript later, hopefully next year, I hope. But it's done and should go off to the publisher soon. So it's to find lectures on Reformed theology from the Civil War right down the road from Charles I's pro tem parliament, is at least a provocative source and an exciting thing to explore. The second one is, I've argued, is a rough draft of the Irish Articles in Usher's handwriting. It's been disputed in modern historiography whether the tradition that Usher was the author of the Articles was correct. I think now we have proof. There is, in fact, an account. So they are in Latin, the rough draft, but there's an account by Usher's grandson that the convocation appointed Usher to write the Articles in Latin. And here we have this document where it's in Usher's handwriting. It looks like a confession of faith. It's the same kind of thing. A lot of it is reused in a translated form in the Irish Articles, in the English final version. And so I think there's a powerful case to be made that this is what they are. So those are probably two of the more exciting sources that I use. I think that covers what you'd asked me there.
That's great, Harrison. So could you tell us maybe how all of this comes together in Usher's doctrine of predestination?
Yeah, so older literature on, to set the context, older literature on covenant theology tried to set the doctrine of predestination and the doctrine of covenant theology in opposition to each other in the Reformed tradition, sort of arguing that there was the predestinarian stream of Reformed theology, there was the covenantal stream, you know, the Geneva school under Calvin focused on God's decree and God's sovereignty and God's predestination. The sort of other school under Bullinger and that kind of person, Bucer, Bullinger, focused a bit more on, you know, these historical outworkings of what God was doing in his relationship and set these as at least in tension. That's the background of why this is an important question, because it seems more recent literature has demonstrated these weren't opposing themes. In fact, Reformed people all believed that God decreed everything that would come to pass, but he also made covenants with his people. And so covenant, in the way that Usher, you know, explains it, is the outworking of God's decree. So I have argued, at least, that Usher leaned a little bit superlapsarian. I think that some people may object to that, but we'll have to wait to see how that falls out under reviews and that kind of and responses. He seemed to think that one of the reasons why God made a covenant with Adam, where there was a probation with this tree of knowledge of good and evil, is so that Adam would fall. He says that that was one of the purposes. So there was part of the decree, of course, was that Adam would not pass his probation and that people would come to be saved in Jesus Christ, in the Son of God. And so the covenant of grace as the foil of sorts to the covenant of works is one where God's people don't earn everlasting life in the new creation like Adam could have done in this covenant of works. But in this covenant of grace, Jesus Christ earns everlasting life for them. And they receive it from him by faith alone. Well, that actually brings together a lot of the Reformed emphases. Salvation by faith alone. God has been sovereignly at work in predestination, and yet God has been engaged in history by working these things, by working out his decree through covenants. So Usher spends a lot of time, a lot of emphasis and energy emphasizing how covenants are the outworking of God's decree in predestination.
That's great, Harrison. Well, listen, we've taken up a lot of your time today talking about this really impressive new book, Catholicity and the Covenant of Works, James Usher and the Reformed Tradition, just published by Oxford University Press. But before we wind up our conversation, could you tell us what you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, well, so like I mentioned, I've done an edition of some of Usher's manuscripts. That's been accepted for publication and is basically wrapped up. But I hope that people will keep an eye out for that to come out, I hope soon. One of the things I'm working, well, also, if they keep an eye out for the journal, The Confessional Presbyterian, I've transcribed some of Usher's manuscripts there and also have an article on Usher's life and his relationship to the Reformed tradition. That should be out later this year. And then I'm doing a a theological book on covenant theology. So the Usher book is a historical treatment. And now I'm trying to do from the perspective of systematic theology, essentially, why should people believe the covenant of works, covenant of grace, and covenant of redemption? So that's the next big thing. I'm about seven chapters in. I think it'll be 11 or 12 chapters, and I'm hoping to propose that to a publisher soon now that I have a rounded idea. But that's the major stuff that I'm working on at the moment.
Well, that sounds great, Harrison. Hopefully at some point we'll have you back on the show to talk about some of those projects.
I'd love to come back. It's been a delight to be with you.
Well, thanks for your time and take care. Thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.